Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the diplomatic efforts underway between U.S. Secretary of State Kerry and Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu to end the latest war in Gaza. Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who covers national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, and Rolling Stone, and is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, joins us. He is the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and we will discuss the extent to which Israeli intelligence services, in particular Shin Bet, used religion to thwart Palestinian nationalism by encouraging the growth of Hamas from 1967 to 1987, during which time the number of mosques tripled in Gaza from 200 to 600. Then we will speak with Nina Krusheva, a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School, whose latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We will discuss if and when the verdict in the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner implicates Russia and Vladimir Putin. Will it damage his popularity with the Russian people, who so far see him as a skillful tactician, not someone who has damaged Russia's economic interests and global reputation through irresponsible brinkmanship? Then finally, we'll get an assessment of Joko Widodo, the new leader of the world's fourth most populous country, the third largest democracy, and the biggest Muslim nation, Indonesia. Sylvia Tuan, a professor of South and Southeast Asian Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Breaking the Spell, Colonialism and Literary Renaissance in Indonesia, joins us to discuss the challenge by General Prabowo, who lost the recent election by 53% to 47%, and whether the populist policies of the new leader will break the grip of the military in Indonesian politics and slow the destruction of the country's rainforests and ease the oppression of its indigenous peoples. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, and Israel, the war on terrorism and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, and Rolling Stone. He is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He also has an article at The Nation, Obama Fiddles While Gaza Burns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks. A pleasure to be here.
You've also written about the extent to which Shin Bet and other Israeli intelligence organizations essentially helped create Hamas. But let's begin with the current situation. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, is in Israel after having been in Egypt, where he's been meeting with the Egyptian leaders, Palestinian Authority leaders, and also Ban Ki-moon, the UN head of the UN. And now he's meeting with Netanyahu. It feels like, is this orchestrated in any way, that he's been off there on this futile effort to broker some peace between people who essentially are on the margins of the issue, although Egypt does play a rather large role, and now he's in Israel, and maybe now it's time for this thing to end?
Well, I don't know if it's ready to call it a futile effort. I mean, if there's anybody who can broker a ceasefire, it's going to be the United States, and that's in part, I guess, because the United States has a great deal of leverage over Israel, which, if it's ever exercised, it's exercised behind the scenes. But I think there's some evidence that both President Obama and Secretary Kerry have pretty much had it with the Israeli excesses in this attack on Gaza. And so while for political reasons at home, not wanting to open themselves up to criticism from the right and Israel's advocates here, they maintain an exceedingly even-handed or overly even-handed, if that's possible, perspective. I think that if the United States wants to end this conflict, they're in the right position to do it. On the other hand, not too many of the players in the region are of a mood to listen to the United States. That includes Egypt and Israel and the Palestinians among them. It's going to take some doing. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy that's unfolding there. And I think it's becoming increasingly obvious to the whole world. Even the UN is now saying that Israel may be guilty of war crimes in its excessive zeal to go after Hamas. I don't know if Netanyahu has clearly thought this through in terms of what's his end game, what he hopes to accomplish, other than just to, you know, bludgeon Gaza once again.
Well, when you mentioned the Palestinians were involved in these negotiations that went on in Cairo, of course, this is the Palestinian Authority, which essentially has no traction or credibility, I think, with Hamas, even though they had a brief unity government there. And, of course, this situation is making the PA look more and more irrelevant. So I'm not sure what Abbas can bring to the table. And, of course, the General Sisi, the new military head of Egypt, his whole project is being against the Muslim Brotherhood, who are the sort of genesis of Hamas, and he's closed off the border. And it does seem, as you point out, election politics and fundraising are a big issue here. The president on Wednesday, of course, is in Los Angeles for a big fundraiser, so he's not about to in any way, I think, upset any potential donors. So it seems that the only glimmers we have that the U.S. is in any way upset with Israel or prepared to make any kind of stand are from off-mic comments by Secretary of State Kerry.
Well, you know, sometimes those are a lot more revealing than anything that people say on the record. I mean, I think it goes too far to say that donors to the Democratic Party are, you know, controlling events. This is a grand geopolitical game that's unfolding, and the United States does have real interests in the Middle East. On the other hand, I think it's always then balanced against the domestic issues, and I think Obama would be just as concerned about criticism from the Republicans and their allies, especially in an election year, who would, try to take advantage of any opening to criticize Obama if he were to make explicit differences with Israel. On the other hand, though, I would say that there seem to be some polls, and I'm not following the polls too closely, but that indicate that Americans increasingly are unhappy with the closeness of the U.S.-Israel alliance. And I think the more that Israel uses this kind of overweening force that it's using, it's going to damage its standing in the United States, and so make it, therefore, easier for the president or maybe the next president to get a little tougher with the Israelis.
But most presidents, perhaps with the exception of George W. Bush, certainly his father, had a pretty prickly time with Shamir, and there's no question that Bill Clinton, after his first Oval Office meeting with Netanyahu, turned in his exasperation to his aides and said, "Who is the effing superpower around here?" And it's no secret that Obama doesn't have a particularly good relationship with Netanyahu. So that leads you to ask the question, well, if the most powerful men in the world don't seem to be able to influence the leader of Israel, who can?
Well, of course, they can influence the leader of Israel. But, you know, the Israelis have a great deal of freedom of action since they act kind of lightning fast. And this is a scenario that's played out many, many times where the Israelis go into Lebanon or into Gaza or even in the during the Bush administration, you know, militarily surrounding Yasser Arafat's old compound on the West Bank. And they, you know, wreak a lot of damage, and then they eventually pull back because they can. I think that if the president really wanted to get the Israelis to pay attention, if he were to speak out more forcefully, that would undermine Netanyahu, because above all, the Israeli voters know that Israel is ultimately dependent on goodwill and military and economic support from the United States. And so if it looked like the Prime Minister of Israel was in danger of, you know, trashing that relationship, he would lose a lot of support domestically. And that's something that I had hoped that Obama and Kerry would use that leverage, you know, when they were trying to work out a peace plan during that nine-month-long shuttle diplomacy that Kerry just concluded a month ago. They kept talking about, we're going to announce an American peace plan for the Israel-Palestine problem. And if they had done that and done it strongly enough, it would have put a lot of pressure on the Israelis to nod and say, yes, yes, we agree with that plan. But they never did. And so maybe that's a sign that they really aren't willing to challenge this this status quo and to use the power and influence that the United States really does have.
And of course, though, the fastest rising and growing political party and force in Israel are to the right of Netanyahu. So, I mean, we have this odd situation in the world today where there are forces to the right of Putin, as bad as he is. There are forces to the right of Netanyahu, as bad as many see him in terms of the peace process. And here in the United States, as bad as John Boehner and Mitch McConnell may seem to a lot of people, the Tea Party people to the right of them are even worse. So that's one of the odd things about the world we're in today, is it not?
Well, I don't know if that's so odd. I think that's pretty much, you know, par for the course. We could say the same thing about Iran, where you have a government in Iran which is trying to work out a deal on its nuclear program, and they in turn have, you know, some pretty tough-minded hardliners at home. But it's the job of governments, you know, to negotiate their own domestic situations. And I don't know if Netanyahu is constrained by these right-wing forces. I do know that there's a constituency in Israel for a deal with the Palestinians, but Netanyahu is not only, you know, in that camp, but is actively trying to undermine it at this point. And so, you know, I think we got to put the blame on Netanyahu and not allow him to claim that he's, you know, hamstrung by people to his right. As far as the Tea Party goes, I mean, I don't know that they have any influence in the Obama administration or over American policy. I think they're a bigger problem for the Republicans than they are for the Democrats.
But even so, the pundits seem to think that the Republicans have a good chance of picking up the Senate in the midterms coming up and paralyzing Obama. But again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, and Israel, the war on terror and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and he is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and the author of The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He's also has an article at The Nation, Obama Fiddles While Gaza Burns. And in your article, of course, at The Nation, you know, have lots of transcripts from the government, from the official U.S. position, pointing out how feckless it is in the face of what is growing outrage around the world about what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza.
But yeah, I mean, of course, I wrote that piece at the beginning
ago.
Of this current crisis, sure. Or just after it had gotten underway. And I think, you know, that was long before the Israelis militarily moved into Gaza and led to this incredible, you know, skyrocketing of Palestinian casualties, now in the many, many hundreds. I think since then the United States has begun to engage, whereas before it was just keeping a pure kind of hands-off strategy, maybe doing something behind the scenes, but just hoping that the rocket fire from Gaza and the Israeli airstrikes would just sort of, you know, come to an end, and in the early efforts there were to, you know, to make a ceasefire. But I would say that Obama is no longer fiddling, but he's certainly not, you know, plunging in yet. And on the other hand, sending Kerry to the region is certainly a bigger step than keeping a hands off, you know, toward the problem.
Well, of course, though, in 2009, before Obama took office, President Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice basically gave Israel a blank check to do what they wanted in Gaza. And that didn't resolve the situation. I spoke yesterday to an analyst in Jerusalem who was saying that the Israeli press are totally on board with this operation, and that there's a feeling in Israel that this time around they're going to deal with Hamas once and for all. And isn't that just a chimera? Aren't we just, you know, this is a Groundhog Day operation, isn't it?
Well, I would think it is. Of course, the fact that the Israeli population is on board, that's not unusual in any country. The vast majority of Americans supported the Iraq War when it started, and so did the Russians support Putin's Crimea adventure. So, you know, people tend to support their leaders' adventurism overseas or in wars when they begin, until the casualties start mounting and until the cost starts, you know, being felt. I think, you know, this is a open question what the Israelis think they can accomplish. You could make the argument that by attacking Gaza, they're building up support for Hamas. I don't know if that's true. I don't know what the people in Gaza really think. I'm sure that a number of them are extremely angry and blame Israel for the deaths and the destruction there. On the other hand, maybe there's, you know, some of them are turning against Hamas for their fairly foolish strategy of sending aimless rockets toward Israel with no idea of what they intended to accomplish, or building these ridiculous tunnels, you know, where they can hope to send a few guerrillas into Israel. For what purpose, I don't know. Israel cannot be defeated militarily, and so the only solution in any medium term is a political one, not a military one. I have no idea what Hamas is thinking. I have no idea what the Israelis are thinking.
Sure. Well, you know, Hamas means zeal in Arabic, so maybe they're not thinking. But let's just, in the last couple of minutes, Robert Dreyfus, talk about the extent to which Hamas was in many ways assisted in its creation by Israeli intelligence services, especially Shin Bet. And, of course, there's a long history of, going back to the Dulles brothers of the U.S., using fundamentalist Islam to defeat Arab socialism. And, of course, it came to its zenith in the Afghan war when we supported al-Qaeda, or people that turned out to be al-Qaeda, against the Russians. Just give us a quick sketch of the evidence there. That, some of the evidence, of course, comes from Yasser Arafat himself, who was quoted by a newspaper reporter a number of years ago describing Hamas as a creature of Israel. And apparently Arafat also discussed this with Yitzhak Rabin during the Oslo process, where Rabin is reported to have told Arafat that it was a fatal error for the Israelis to have encouraged the growth of Hamas, obviously as a hedge against Palestinian nationalism.
Well, you described it. I think, you know, back in the 1970s, when the Palestinian national movement was, you know, beginning to flex its muscles, the Israelis believed at that time, some of them did, that religious Palestinians, Muslims, would be an effective counterweight to the Palestinian national movement, both its leftist versions and its more centrist and nationalist versions. And so they allowed Ahmed Yassin and the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza and the West Bank to expand dramatically the number of mosques, to carry out really, you know, covert political activities, to build up campus groups long before Hamas was formally established in 1987. And so in those 20 years between 67, when the territories were occupied, and 87, when Hamas was established, they built a very powerful infrastructure. They often went to military conflicts, you know, battling on campuses and in other areas against the PLO, against Fatah, against other parts of the Palestinian movement. And the Israelis believed that this would divide and conquer the Palestinians. And I think you can make the case that even since then, since Hamas emerged as a militant threat to Israel now, it's kind of a Frankenstein's monster, it still provides for many Israelis on the right a useful foil, because they can point to Hamas and say, we can't negotiate with the Palestinians because these radical people, you know, are out for our heads and won't make peace. And so, you know, there are plenty of indications over the last 20 years where the Israelis would deliberately provoke the situation, you know, radicalizing opinion in a way that helped Hamas get more powerful, because they didn't want the PLO or Fatah to become too all-powerful and then present itself as a moderate negotiating partner. So the Israelis have often seen Hamas as a way of convincing the rest of the world that they have no partner for peace, and that's unfortunate. I think it would be smart for the United States and the rest of the world to talk to Hamas, to include them, to not demonize them when they join, let's say, in this new Palestinian unity government that they're trying to create. But unfortunately, the Israelis seem to have a veto power over that, and they ultimately control the area militarily. So it's very difficult for anybody else to get in and out of Gaza, to support Gaza economically or politically. And so it's, you know, it's a, I don't know, kind of a circular argument now that's being made, is we have nobody to talk to, and that creates more radicals who don't want to talk. And so that's the dynamic that's underway, and now we're seeing it in its ugliest form in this war in Gaza today.
Well, Robert Dreyfuss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, and Israel, the war on terror, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, and Rolling Stone. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He also has an article at The Nation, Obama Fiddles While Gaza Burns. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether a guilty verdict in the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Kusheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book, just out, is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Thank you.
And it does seem that this situation in Ukraine with the shootdown of the Malaysian jet and the chances now that the Europeans will ratchet up sanctions, apparently President Obama is spending a lot of effort on persuading them to do so. The British Prime Minister referred to this as a defining moment for Vladimir Putin. Up until now, it would seem that he's handled things, as far as the Russian people are concerned, brilliantly. He took over Crimea without firing a shot, And they see him, I think, as a pretty clever strategist. If this thing blows up in his face, will that cause his 80%+ approval ratings to reverse?
Well, it depends on how it's going to blow up in his face, because I don't think he's strategically brilliant. I think he's tactically brilliant, and so far all these things are very great tactical advantages, because none of them really speak into the future of Russia. What does it mean that, you know, so Crimea is now part of Russia. What does it mean exactly? Let's think of how much it's going to cost. Now, East Ukraine has been in total shambles, really. When the rebels go away, whether Donetsk region will stay within Ukraine, will become an independent place, independent enclave, whether Russia will take it, although it doesn't seem that Putin is so eager, really, to take it. How it is going to play out in the long term. First of all, relationship between the two nations or between the two peoples are completely ruined. I mean, I don't even see how that can work out in the future at all. So that's what we're talking about. We talk about sort of this immediate responses of the public, and I don't think that the public will continue to support this kind of behavior, because, you know, we can say, or people say, oh, it's they didn't shoot it on purpose. Well, it doesn't matter that they didn't shoot it on purpose. They did shoot it, and the fact that Putin did start this kind of tug of war between the two places, and now it is a war, really brings all these casualties of war. And in the fog of war, we really forget what it is all about. Supposedly, the Russian lives or Russian-speaking people in East Ukraine are supposed to be protected, but now they are not protected. People who had nothing to do with this conflict, such as almost 200 citizens of the Netherlands, another 100 people of other countries, nothing to do with that. So I don't really think that strategically is going to play out for Putin. As for blowing in his face, it depends on how far Europe is going to go with this, because so they've been great international outrage and great European outrage. Great, fine, wonderful. And at the same time, we get information that the French that were supposed to sell Putin to missiles, Mistral missiles, actually are going to go ahead with that. So I think it's a little disingenuous for the West, or I guess Europe, to ask Putin to back off. Then at the same time, they continue to encourage him because they're not really punishing him.
But given that apparently 2/3 of the Russian people are against a military invasion of Ukraine, and as you've just said, this whole situation has poisoned the Ukrainians, and I believe that even in eastern Ukraine, there is much less sympathy for Russia than there was before. So if this investigation were to cast the blame against Russia and Putin, I mean, surely if his reputation and integrity is not hurt, then his, I said tech before, strategic skills, I'll change it for what you suggested, his tactical skills, the Russians' respect for them will evaporate, won't they?
Well, exactly. I agree with you, because, I mean, Russians are whatever Russians are, or maybe, I mean, they certainly did not settle down to shoot people from the skies. And you know, there's a lot of reports in the United States of how inhumanely the remains were treated. And it is true, because those separatists, they are there for the power. They are there as a zone of war, and therefore they don't have to uphold to civilized rules. But, you know, what we didn't get much to hear about is how the villages were responding, and they were putting flowers, and they were really trying to preserve the remains with as much dignity as they could. And there were prayers and vigils for the fallen. But unfortunately, those who control that environment, or the separatists, they really create a horrible image, because they are called pro-Russian, pro-Kremlin. They I think, great PR disaster for Putin, and therefore Putin himself is very much distancing from them. But at the same time, what I find really remarkable, as good as he is at propaganda, he's not really that great at PR, obviously, because in order to show that he's compassionate, as much as he always says, well, the West is calculating and we're kind, wonderful people, the Russians, you know, he himself didn't show much compassion and spoke about the tragedy very laconically and kind of almost not involved. And I think that really hurt his image. You know, whatever we think of the Western, as Russians, we think of the West that, you know, Putin is so bravely standing up to, Russians are kind. I mean, and for example, he himself did not, as far as I know, didn't go and, you know, sign a condolence book at the Dutch embassy in Moscow. But there are numerous, I mean, millions and millions of little handwritten notes from people saying, please forgive us, we are not killers. So Russians understand that even if, you know, a Russian person or a Russian military person did not pull the trigger of that missile, Russia is involved, Russia is guilty of that, and Russians don't want to bear this responsibility. And that ultimately would hurt Putin.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book just out is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. But I've noticed, Nina Kosheva, that Putin he's never said that the rebels in the separatists had nothing to do with the shooting down of this plane. Instead, he's been consistently blaming Ukraine for attacking the rebels. So it seems like he's already laid the groundwork for some wriggle worm.
Oh, absolutely. And, well, I mean, he actually didn't say that they're not involved. He just said that the blame is on Ukrainian government because they escalated, 2 weeks ago, they escalated the cleanup operation. So they are guilty because it's on their territory. But that's why, there have been some reports, there's some really fantastic propaganda/conspiracy theories running around Moscow, why the Ukrainian government did it, because, you know, allegedly one story alleges that they wanted to kill Putin, another story alleges that there was a hired CIA plane with dead bodies already. So dead bodies just fell down from the sky just to set up Russia. And I mean, it's really ridiculous to the point of no return. But what is important with this kind of lies is that you can't really deflate them, because you deflate one, you say, well, no, facts suggest X, Y, Z. They don't care about facts. The point is that they create a perception. And so they have this remarkable plausible deniability, because if you don't buy the CIA story, then the Ukrainian government body story. If you don't buy the dead bodies already being loaded on the plane in Amsterdam, then there is something else. And so in some ways, I think this investigation will never prove that Russia is directly involved. But Russia is directly involved by creating an environment in which people who have no training and basically only concerned for their own power, because that's what these leaders are. They really play this interesting game of I'm a prime minister, you know, the titles, the sort of the newly found power claims. And so these Russians have created this kind of irresponsible behavior on the part of this newly born politician / militant / thugs. And I think for that, Russia is very responsible.
And then specifically, you're referring to Colonel Strelkov, who is in fact a Russian. He's the one who came up with this bizarre conspiracy theory about the dead bodies being loaded on the plane by the CIA and dumped over the fields of eastern Ukraine. In fact, I spoke the other day to Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, who's a defense analyst, and he actually provided what seemed to me to be a fairly logical explanation for what's happening militarily and why the decision to shoot the plane down happened. He said that the Ukrainian military had been making serious advances against the rebels, and of course, today, two Ukrainian jet fighters apparently were shot down. But, you know, they were apparently advancing on them, and that the rebels were starting to collapse. and that the Ukrainian military had sent pockets of soldiers into the border area with Russia to stop the flow of material crossing the border, and that they needed to resupply these pockets of Ukrainian soldiers from the air with airdrops, and that's why Russia introduced the missiles to shoot down the planes to level the playing field. And that seems to be the game that's being played here, a carefully calibrated destabilization. So does that scenario make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and we know that before the plane went down, there were already three other planes were shot down, two military, two fighters, and one transport plane. So it's almost proven that there was supposed to be Ukrainian transport plane in that area, and the rebels made a mistake. But the point is, yes, it was. I mean, and they were just shooting up. And I think Strelkov, you very correctly analyzed that. Strelkov was the one who is kind of, he sees himself as that knight errant of the past in Russian. It is Bogatyr, and he's going to stand up to the Western invasion of great Russian spirit and soul and land. So they would shoot at anything. I mean, for them, something is flying. I mean, one of the explanations, for example, was, well, what are this? I mean, fine, foreign plane, who cares? What are they doing flying over our territory? They must be carrying spies. I mean, it was already after the plane was shot down, not that they wanted to shoot the passenger plane down. But what it did, they immediately deflated responsibility by saying, well, if it's flying over our territory, it must be carrying spies. So absolutely, but that is direct blame falls on Putin, because if you start war like that, if you start begin such an environment, then you really have to be responsible for those parties who are involved. And suddenly, for example, when he's asked to de-escalate them, he says, oh, it's foreign territory, I have no control over it. Wait a minute, you were just arguing that they're your people, so why is it a foreign territory? And by the way, in Crimea, it didn't stop him, although it was also foreign territory. So all these things, I mean, that's what I mean by kind of, it's very difficult to address propaganda and deflate it, but what is important is, he's a very rich man, and he obviously values money because it brings him power, but also because he can get this money having the power he already has. Well, his country needs to be punished. He himself needs to be punished, and I think we'll see how long that power will last then.
Well, in terms of what Obama's apparently trying to do, which is to get the Europeans to increase sanctions, it's pretty clear that the British will go along with the U.S. And the fact that the British have reopened the Litvinenko case, right, I think is very telling. I think probably a deal was done back then. They had the evidence that the orders came from Russian intelligence, if not from the Kremlin itself. And they decided, the Brits decided to back off in deference to Putin being the head of state. It'd be difficult to call a head of state a murderer and back away from that. But it does seem now that the fact that they've reopened this case may be that they've decided that deal is off.
Well, I'm not entirely sure, because I have issues with that whole theory that with Litvinenko theory, that the Kremlin, because he himself said that the Kremlin wanted to kill him. Putin is KGB, Litvinenko is KGB. As far as I know, in my knowledge of KGB, each and every one of KGB members do what's convenient for them at certain particular times. So I have to say, I'm on the side of caution of who killed Litvinenko. My suspicion easily, and it's only a suspicion, but it could easily be they were doing, because all the KGB people have been doing various business deals on the side involving KGB materials or whatever, the spy materials, those
polonium.
Gas, whatever it was they were developing at the time of their heyday. So I need to see that investigation. It would come to its conclusion. I think for me, what's more important about this investigation, whether there was a deal with the Kremlin, I cannot speak to that, of course, but it is it is really embarrassing to the Kremlin that that story died down, and now yet again that story is back in the news. So Putin is being very much cornered, because I honestly don't think it will ever be proven, whatever it is, with Litvinenko. But the fact that it's there and hanging, once again, is bad news for Putin. On the other hand, Putin is a very clever man, and every time the story like that comes out, they have one explanation that so far has worked quite a bit for the Russians, and that's why he has this 80% approval, is that, you know, the West lies, the West is always out to get us. So the Litvinenko investigation can be easily dismissed, is just that.
But what's also going on with that propaganda effort, which obviously Putin cannot reverse, he's whipped up the Russian people, his polls numbers are about 83%. He's not about to sell out his proxies in eastern Ukraine, nor is he about to reverse the propaganda machine. But I'm interested, since you're in your new book, Nina Khrushcheva, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, you talk about he was, as far as you're concerned, growing up, Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, was your grandfather, because your real grandfather, his son Leonid, died in the war. He was a brave wartime pilot and a war hero who was later branded a traitor. And that sort of leads me to this idea of how it is that you can have this kind of cognitive dissonance in a way in Russia, where the most outrageous things are said by the media, the state-controlled media, which now we're back to the Soviet days under Putin, and the real evidence of how absolutely outrageous these claims are. The fact that Stalin gave your grandfather medals and then later decided that he was a traitor. Just how can people navigate those extremes?
Thank you for asking that. That's exactly a fantastic question. It actually feeds very well into all these claims of, you know, dead bodies being thrown from the skies, or it's a CIA plane set up to sort of sent to set up Russia. These stories are impossible to deconstruct, just because for one story, say, and that's what my book also is about. I mean, some parts of it is that how, when the story appeared that suddenly, allegedly, Khrushchev's son, my grandfather Leonid, was a traitor rather than a war hero, which he was known to be until late 60s. Suddenly, you know, you come to a prosecution, you come to the judges with facts and information and documents, and they would just dismiss the case, and the misinformation continues. So it's, you know, you cut one head and three groves back. So that's exactly what has been happening with the Putin propaganda state. And I think for the people, it's very difficult to navigate in a way is that, fine, as I mentioned, you don't believe in the CIA plot with the Malaysian flight, then you believe that it's the Ukrainian government that was trying to kill Putin. In Khrushchev's case, fine, you don't believe that Leonid Khrushchev's son, was a traitor, but because the story appeared, that must be something to him. And I think that's what sort of that makes Russian sanity very problematic, because brings us back to why Russians support Putin. Not that they necessarily believe him, not that they believe his lies, but because this sort of anti-Western buzz is so dramatic and really has increased in the last 15 Putin years. So what are you going to believe? You're not believing your own state, but you're even less going to believe those Westerners who, as we know, and I put it as we know in quotes, as we know, are always out to get us. So in the Khrushchev case, it's also very interesting, because Khrushchev is, you know, well known. He denounced Stalin in 1956. He himself was Stalin's supporter before Stalin died in 1953. Then he sort of went against Stalin and started his own policy of de-Stalinization. But Putin's hero is Stalin. He didn't say it in that many words, but heroically, Stalin was putting lands together. He fought World War II, and then Khrushchev came and denounced him. So even silently, even with the very few words, your worldview is being skewed and create a certain vision of the world in which, fine, you know, Stalin did a lot of bad things. He killed a lot of people, but he was a great statesman. Putin is a great statesman. Who denounced Stalin? Khrushchev denounced Stalin. By definition, Khrushchev is not a great statesman. By definition, if Khrushchev is bad, then his son also must be bad. So let's make him bad. He is a traitor in World War II. I mean, this is just, that's how classic propaganda works. It's sort of you skew only one part of it, and the next logical line becomes even more slanted and more slanted, and you ultimately get to the traitor part.
And of course, that's what Putin has revived through his surrogates, that your grandfather was a traitor, an old canard from the 60s. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book just out is The Lost Khrushchev, a journey into the gulag of the Russian mind. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back getting an assessment of the new leader of Indonesia, Joko Widodo.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sylvia Tiwan, who's a professor in the South and Southeast Asian Studies Department at UC Berkeley. She is on the advisory board of the Encyclopedia of Women in Islamic Cultures and on the editorial board of the journal Critical Asian Studies. Her work includes the book Breaking the Spell, Colonialism and Literary Renaissance in Indonesia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sylvia Tiwan.
Thank you.
And the world's fourth and most populous country and its third largest democracy and the biggest Muslim nation on the planet has just elected a new leader, Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi. But of course, the general he beat is contesting the election, even though I think the margin is, 53% to 47%. Is Prabowo likely to prevail?
I doubt that he will prevail, but he will certainly make life a little bit miserable for a bit. Although the thing that, you know, he's talking about having a mandate of, well nigh 50% of the population. However, the votes that came to Prabowo are actually the results of his coalition with the Golkar, which is Suharto's old party, and other some Muslim parties who now, that coalition is now breaking up. So, you know, in the legislative elections, Prabowo's party, the Gerindra, got very few votes, I think, 11%.
So this is, though, the first president, at least in the recent era, in Indonesia, who has not come out of the elite or the military. He has fairly humble roots, and of course, General Prabowo that he ran against is the son-in-law of Suharto, the dictator. So the extent to which Joko Widodo is being labeled a populist, would you agree with that?
I don't see him as being particularly filling the model of a populist, but somebody who is very popular because of his ordinary roots. He doesn't make an ideology of it, which is why I don't think of him as being a populist in that way. But for him, it's very important to go back to Indonesia's roots that are outside the military and outside an established political elite. So this is a very important step away from the new order, away from Suharto's regime. The term in Indonesian is kerakyatan, which means man of the people.
But when you say this is a move back to traditional Indonesia politics as opposed to military-dominated politics, are you referring to the Sukarno years?
Yes, the early days of the Indonesian Republic, which we can't really call the Sukarno years, you know, very strictly, because it wasn't a presidential system then. It was a cabinet, a prime minister who was in charge. But those were the days when you had free elections, freedom, you know, to associate. This was before the Communist Party was disbanded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot more freedom in the air.
Well, when you say the Communist Party was disbanded, it was essentially wiped out in a massacre, was it not?
That is very true. It was basically destroyed. But disbanded also means that in the imagination of the people, it's no longer supposed to exist.
Are we then to breathe a sigh of relief that the general did not get elected, even though he's contesting? I mean, in this rather bitter campaign that took place, one of the general's superior officers referred to him as a psychopath. So it's a scary concept, isn't it, having somebody that has that kind of reputation?
It is. Well, he has a reputation for being very emotional, you know, showing anger very quickly, panicking, which you'd think would not be the sort of thing that a military man should display. But be that as it may, the collective sigh of relief is enormous. There was a real fear that this would be the reincarnation of the Suharto's new order.
Well, of course, and had he been elected, even though he lost it for 53-47 margin, he's still contesting. But apparently, he came out of nowhere in the polls, this general, largely through the help of right-wing American election consultants.
Yeah, that's the irony of the whole thing. You know, at the same time that he's attacking America for being, you know, this Western power that is throwing its weight around, using democracy to disempower Indonesians and to sow the seeds of dissent everywhere, which means, you know, he's against human rights. Despite that, he's still using these Republican consultants, and, you know, the what they did to Jokowi was this huge smear campaign, labeling him communist. I mean, it seems so close to what they were doing to Obama at one point, you know, labeling him socialist or communist, whichever way you like it.
Well, Sylvia Tiwan, what do you think will happen under this new president in terms of reversing the environmental and ecological damage to Indonesia, where so much of the rainforests are being cut down for palm oil plantations? And when they cut down and clear the jungle, they burn off the foliage, mm-hmm. to the point where
That is the other Indonesian tragedy. You know, we talk about the massacres of 65, 68 as the Indonesian tragedy, but the massacre of the rainforest is its second tragedy. And for this, well, Prabowo Subianto, you know, was heavily involved in logging industries. That was one of his things. Jokowi is a furniture maker. I don't see his program as being very clear on environmental protection and reversing the damage that is done. There are a few points that make me optimistic. One of them being, you know, his emphasis on repairing things rather than extending, you know, clearing more forests to create new rice fields. He's more into, you know, repairing irrigation that has been neglected for so long, etc., which I think will do a great deal for improving food security in Indonesia. The other point of hope is that he was working very closely with teams of volunteers from human rights and environmental activists. So they have a big stake in what in his victory, and he has a large stake in them. And I certainly hope that this dialogue will continue.
And how much do you think the outrage expressed by Malaysia and Singapore that they couldn't breathe the air for a while because of the fires from clearing the forests in Indonesia, does that resonate at all?
A little bit. I'm not so sure about that. What I think ought to resonate even more is the people, the indigenous people around those forests who can breathe even less, mm-hmm. whose lands have been decimated, whose whole huge portions of these islands are just destroyed. These are the people that, if one looks at, you know, economic development, etc., as being strengthening local populations, then these are the people who really are suffering the most. And it's a good way of opening the dialogue into, you know, the need to save the forest, rather than just saying, well, people in Malaysia and Singapore can't breathe.
Sure. Well, would this mean then that the Melanesians in West Irian, who are subject to Indonesian rule, will they be treated any better, do you think, under this new leadership?
I hope so. I hope that Jokowi, as president, will have a much clearer vision and a good political will to deal with the problems in Papua, West Irian, you know, we generally call it Papua. And the problem with the current president is that there is no political will. You know, he's all over the... He shilly-shallies whichever way the wind blows. And we hope that Jokowi will be the kind of person who can take a good, reasoned stance and be respected by people enough so that policy on Papua will follow the roadmaps that have been put together by any number of people, you know, to create peace, to give to Papuans what they really need in good dialogue with Indonesia, rather than spinning off into some conflict that then has to be resolved with military force.
Well, Sylvia Tiwan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Tiwan, who's a professor in the South and Southeast Asian Studies Department at UC Berkeley. She is on the advisory board of the Encyclopedia of Women and Islamic Cultures and on the editorial board of the journal Critical Asian Studies. Her work includes the book Breaking the Spell, Colonialism and Literary Renaissance in Indonesia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.